Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fabulous fireside room, the speaker is Diane Shelton, speaking on words to heal the conflicts. So, let's listen in on Diane.
My name is Diane Shelton. I'm from Mankato, Minnesota. I teach special education primarily in the area of early childhood. For the district, school district there, and I also teach classes at the college level, so I get to see a wide span. Today, this is one of my favorite topics that we'll be talking about, words that heal. And hopefully, as this session goes on, there will be some shifts in how we perceive or look at communication and conflict resolution. It's not going to be specifically conflict resolution. It's a little different than that. It's kind of a preventative thing is what I'm about here. The first thing I'd like you to do is just take a minute and think. I can find my sheet. Think of what hurts your heart. Think of something that hurts your heart. Not something that mentally makes you angry, but something that can happen to you, something that, a situation that maybe you've been in that has hurt you inside. And now I would like you to think about what heals you. What kinds of things, after you've been hurt, help you feel better? Helps start the healing. Just you. And I'd like to have you just kind of hold that in mind as we go through the hour. Just to kind of get us started and we'll move on. I'd like to start by just briefly reviewing some of the other sessions because I think it helps bring us together. The thing I'd like you to think about, first of all, is in a lot of your sessions, you're learning about the broader world, the big picture, things out there. For this hour, I'd like you to just come in to yourself and think about yourself and your family and the people closest to you. Okay. So make this really personal for yourself. There's nothing right, there's nothing politically correct, there's nothing wrong, just yourself. Okay, so just to review some things that are good standard communication strategies or techniques. One is turn-taking. When we want to know more about a person, we take turns. We listen when they talk, and they listen when we talk. And sometimes we need to name that. We talked about labeling things and naming things in life. We name how we feel. We name what we need or what we want in life. We name name what we expect from our children. And the more naming we do, the more people know what we're about. We talked about wait time this week, but sometimes some of us respond very quickly, that'd be me, and others need time to process and to think about their responses. And when we value someone else and we really want communication, we allow that to happen. We allow people to have time to process and think about maybe what we're naming or labeling in a conversation. We also talked about cues one day. What do we see? What do we observe in terms of the people we care about? How do they respond to life? How do they respond to what happens to them? Can you see it on their face? Can you tell by their body language? Have they shut down because they haven't gotten engaged and responded to? So what are the cues we get? The other thing that we've talked about is motivation and consequences. We really, if we want to engage another person, we need to be motivated to do that. I have to care about you. I have to want to work for that. I have to be invested in you. I was in a relationship for a long time that ended, my marriage actually, and in that marriage there wasn't an investment in each other enough for the communication and engagement to continue or to be meaningful or to help us in our relationship. Then we've talked about the consequences. What are the consequences if we don't communicate and engage with the people we care about? Sometimes the people leave. Sometimes they find someone else. Sometimes they just shut down and we live side by side in our houses, but there's nothing meaningful. Sometimes it becomes intolerable. We have all sorts of coping mechanisms. And we will do it because we will survive one way or another, usually. Sometimes not. But there's just the choice of, are we going to engage in our meaningful relationships, or are we going to live out the consequences of not engaging? Kind of the overlying theme of what I've been talking about this week is weaving meaning in your life through threads of communication. And today, I'm going to be talking a lot about giving people the words to use. So not just expecting that they're going to have the words, but giving people the words to use. I'd like to first start talking about what it means when someone comes to us and tells us something really, really important. When we're a child and we get hurt, typically, who do we run to help us? Mom, dad, teacher, right? And when we're infants and toddlers, there's usually a pretty good response. Oh, let me kiss it. I'll try and make it feel better. Let me hold you. Let me wipe away your tears. And we value that child is hurting, and we're reading the cues, and we hold them, and we touch them, and we help them heal. And then about 3 or 4, children come to us and say, Johnny hit me. Susie took my shovel. And we might say to them, well, you go back and tell them to stop. But very soon we become annoyed with those interruptions. And instead of responding in a healing way, tell me the word that our society uses to label when children come and tell about things in their life. Tattling. Well, the first shift that I'd like everybody in the room to make, that I'd like to suggest, is to say yes to tattling. It's a terrible misnomer. What is different about that 3-year-old coming to you with what is significant at 3? And what I maintain is that at about the age of 3 or 4, we start conditioning children not to tell us what's important to them. And then we're amazed when major things happen in their life, like a friend is going to commit suicide and they don't tell. Or they discover that maybe their sexual orientation is not heterosexual. Or they start experimenting with drugs and they're really scared. And they don't tell us. And they don't name it. And why should they and why would they when they've been told at such a very young age, and they've actually been punished for telling us what's important to them? And then, you know, not only do we say, don't tell me, but we start asking them at a very young age to be extremely abstract thinkers. We say, for instance, and I've heard teachers, I mean, this is extremely common. You can probably all give me examples of it happening to you. A child comes running in from the playground. They've been beaten up over lunch. And the third grade teacher says, wait a minute, that's not my responsibility. That's the playground person's responsibility. Or, now, remember our criteria. Did this hurt you? Did this hurt someone else? Well, sometimes maybe it really hurt my feelings. Does that count? It might be something you can't see. Does that count? What we're finding with research right now is that children are trying to develop, which is extremely developmentally normal, they're trying to figure out the rules. They're trying to figure out what society is asking of them. And their response of checking it out with you, which we've labeled tattling, is punished instead of using that as a teaching tool. So when children come to me and tell me when they're checking out a rule, for instance, you've said, boys and girls, when I'm talking, you need to listen. And little Susie raises her hand and says, well, Mary and Jane are talking back here. And I look at Susan and I say, you know, I'm really glad that you listened and heard what I asked you to do. And often that's all they need. They're just simply checking in. So when I say yes to tattling, what I'm saying is say yes to the importance of every stage of development and what is critical to them. Sometimes that's really hard because you know what? It's more work. But I think we're seeing the consequences in our society of pushing children away in many different ways. We've talked this week about not having time in our schedule. And if you're going to address the social issues that children bring to you, that takes time and energy. But it also is the beginning of the modeling and teaching of how we get along in society. It's not complex. It's simple. Let me see. Tell me your name.
Janet.
And Phyllis. Come on up here just for one quick second. It won't be bad. Promise nobody else. How will you hurt? You two are out in the living room, say. And you said Janice?
Janet.
And Janet wants what Phyllis has. Phyllis, you've got, I don't know, what do you want that she has?
Her shirt.
Her shirt. Give me the shirt off your back. You two get in a scuffle, and Janet pull at her shirt, but just, you know, kind of pretend. Okay, now Phyllis, I'm in the kitchen. You come and tell me what just happened.
Janet just pulled on my shirt.
Go back and just tell her to stop.
Stop!
I did already.
Mom okay. Told me to tell you to stop.
And then usually what's the response at that point? Do they stop?
No.
What happens?
Escalates.
Yeah. It escalates, doesn't it? And have they learned anything from me? No. What message have I basically given them?
Go back.
They're on their own.
Get out of here, you're bothering me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's try it again. Same thing.
Mom, Janet's pulling on my shirt.
Let's go talk to Janet.
We're right here.
Okay, I'm going to give her the words to say, tell her, don't pull on my shirt.
Don't pull on my shirt.
But I want it.
Then you don't tell her, I'd like to wear your shirt someday.
Could I borrow your shirt sometime?
No.
Tell her, you know, it's my shirt, and I like to wear my own clothes.
It's my shirt, and I like to wear my own clothes.
But you know what? Maybe when we go shopping, we could look for one that looks like that.
Oh.
Okay.
Will
thank
you be my mom?
Maybe. You hear that maybe? Children don't learn how to solve conflicts without our intervention. We need to be an active part of that. And that takes practice for us too. It also takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of energy to stop and invest and engage with your children. When I was sitting here and you were over there, there's no engagement. There's no investment. But to have to physically move takes energy. It's the same thing that happens in our schools. There's so much demanded of teachers. I'm not into teacher bashing, I am one. But there's so much demanded of teachers in terms of curriculum, and I guess what I think is we've missed the boat. What we're about at the age that we're going through school is learning how to get along with other people. That's a major, major task. And so, in my opinion, that's where a lot of our energy as adults should be placed. The other thing, when we talk about consequences, is that when you come to me and you tell me you want something, or you share something with me, I need to respond to you. That means I need to give you my attention. I need to look at you, have eye contact, take turns in the interaction. And oftentimes, we need to take it one step further from that, with that, and that was an example. But also, what we know is that children who have been sexually abused, when they talk to their therapist years later, it's not the abuse itself that leaves a long-term scar. I mean, of course, that's important. But the fact that they might have told someone and that person didn't do anything. Again, it's how do we respond to what our children tell us? What energy do we put into it? What I'd like you to try now is to get in a pair, and one of you is going to be the listener, and that's all you're going to do. You may not speak. And the other is going to be the talker. And the listener is going to look at the talker directly with no affect, no response to what the person is going to tell you. Okay? And we'll switch these so that you get to play both roles. The talker is going to tell the listener about an accident they were just in. We're just in a car accident. If some of you can't relate to that or don't, you can come up with your own too. But that's one that I would like. It's pretty traumatic. A pretty traumatic thing to have happen to anyone, those of us that have been in them. So, get with your partner. And I'm going to give you about 30 seconds to describe the accident to the listener who's looking at you, but no verbal response and no affect. All right. All right. So how was it?
Irritating.
Irritating.
A little desperate.
A little desperate.
She kept looking away. I can't stop looking.
Do you feel like telling this person your deepest, darkest secret?
I wouldn't even keep going for 30 seconds.
What?
You know, you would, normally you wouldn't even keep going for 30 seconds.
Oh, but
actually, yeah, I'm kind of hard.
You know what? That's exactly what happens. We do stop. We don't keep going for 30 seconds. And the next time, what we do when we want your attention is we develop behaviors that will get your attention. Because what we need is you. And when I say you, I mean those in your immediate family structure. I will then start developing some behaviors. Okay? If I'm a child, I might start whining. Mom? 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 Would you stop it? That's attention. Okay? Or I might start fighting with my sibling. Because that's going to get her attention. Right? Or I might start trying to tell you everything that's happening in my life. I might just start talking nonstop and not even expect a response. That's the point in that exercise, that if we're not listened to, we will start developing ways to be heard. We will get our needs met one way or another.
Don't you think some people just give up, though? Or a child may just give up and go inside themselves?
They withdraw?
Yeah.
I bet they do. There's a multitude of ways we're going to respond. Each person's going to respond a little bit differently. Some children start acting out. But he's from a good home. We gave him everything he needed. Well, what were the threads of communication like in your home? What happened when he was 10 and came home and had something happen to him while he was playing baseball? And it's not just that one time we don't listen. It's the patterns of not listening. Of not listening to what's important to them, to the other person. And it's the same thing that happens in marriages. Now I'd like you to try that again. And this time, I want you, the listener, to say, tell me more about that. Tell me how you felt, how you're feeling now. Tell me what I can do for you. Okay? So you're going to use words like, these are the words. Tell me more about that. What can I do for you? What can we do together? Okay. Is there a plan? We come up with a plan. So now that's going to be interactive. So we're going to go back to the first, be your first role play. Do your first role play. So you have the ones that were the listeners first are the listeners now, and the talkers are the talkers.
Better. Much better. Still hard to
do. It is. Right. We're not going to get your tow car, your car towed and, you know, get it to the body shop in 30 seconds. What happens?
You get support.
Mm-hmm. Relief.
Relief? Mm-hmm. And how long did it take? How long did it take to start feeling that?
Instant.
It's instantaneous. So it's not as if communication that's engaging and meaningful takes time. It does take thought and energy. I mean, it really does, to bring that to a conscious level.
I even found it easier to make up the story the second time.
Well, let's see. And we could take that off in another time, too.
And that's a question that I have. Young children can be masters at manipulation.
Not only young children.
You know, especially at bedtime. You know, when they want to prolong something, they can...
First of all, I have to tell you that my bias is that I don't like the word manipulation.
Okay.
And the reason is because we're simply doing what we need to do to get what we need. And we all do that. If I need a chocolate fix at 3:00 in the morning, I may get up, get dressed, get in my car, go out and buy it. We'll go to great lengths to get what we need. And children will too. So one of the things that helps a lot is to name what we need. So that child who's using whining to get what they need, oftentimes I'll pick that child up and say, I think you want my attention. And I'd like to give you my attention. I'd like to rock you for a while. Or that child who's following me around the playground telling me, you know, I think you're just really wanting to spend some time next to me. And I really like being next to you. Let's go around and find out what the other children are doing. And that is a wonderful model for them, because we're giving them the name, the words that will help them heal. What we want to do is teach people, children, and ourselves to use words effectively to get what we want and need. So we don't have to hit each other. So we don't have to yell at each other. So we don't have to shut down. So we don't have to go into lots of behaviors to get what we need. Sometimes when I feel lonely, and I'm not, and I don't say that in a way to get my needs met, I might eat more. Which is not directly addressing what I need and want. But you see, when we don't respond to each other, when we're given those messages, when that child is whining, what do we look at usually? Pardon me?
The behavior?
Absolutely. We get so focused on each other's behavior that we miss the bottom line need. The behavior is, I love behavior because it's a great clue. If we look at it as a clue, it's a great one. Because it's saying, look at me, I need something. And the person who's doing the behavior doesn't even often know what they need at that particular point. But we looking outside might be able to say, you seem kind of sad today. I'd like to give you a nice warm hug. And that's the part that I'm going to move into next. Is what can you take from here and use with the people that you live with to help name needs?
This is the obvious question, but I'm going to ask it. You do sit and label it. Maybe that's my upbringing. We never spelled it out.
No.
And you're saying...
You spell it out.
We weren't, I wouldn't occur to my mother to walk up to me and tell her she was a little sad. I wouldn't.
Did she say how she felt? I'm feeling really sad today.
That would be no.
How many of you had parents that labeled how they felt on a regular basis? So that you knew without having to try and guess how mom and dad felt? How many of your parents looked at you, took your cues, and were able to say, you know, it looks like you're feeling a little agitated or nervous about that?
They do other things, but they didn't name them. Mm-hmm.
And when we don't have those names, then it's hard for us to name as adults. You were going to say something?
No, I was raising my hand in response to your question.
It's interesting. My kids at 14 and 11 and a half now, and I thought, well, is this a good, or is this, I couldn't quite decide if this is good or bad. Mom, are you in a good mood? I'm always in. Are you in a good mood? And I thought, well, I'm either, sometimes it has brought me up short that, well, I'm either, I'm convinced my body language is saying that I'm not in, or I'm usually if I'm I'm involved in getting dinner, involved in doing something. Mm-hmm. And my body language is projecting, but I guess I'm...
What is your response to them?
Usually, why? in a friendly, they know sure. I'm joking now. They're kind of, why? Mm-hmm. And it usually brings me up to... I'm conveying something out there.
You are, or they're not reading what you're conveying.
Yeah.
My children have started asking me specifically because I've done it with them. Mom, you look kind of sad. Are you okay? And my first response is, well, you know, thank you for asking me that. I mean, that's to me, that's a real compliment for someone to tune in enough to look at how you're feeling during a day. And then I'll go on to say, oh, I'm thinking about this. Or if I am sad, yeah, I'm feeling a little sad. And this is why.
I just thought they were too old for that. Maybe they're not.
Oh, we're not, are we ever?
Well, I'm going from my background.
I still want to know how people are doing.
Yeah.
I'd like to go through this so that we have a chance to kind of work with a little bit. Think about, as we're going through this, someone that you're close to, and think about a behavior that you see from them that might concern you. A repeated behavior. Does anybody have an example of just a behavior? Do you don't have to tell me anything specific?
Use of sarcasm.
Okay, good. That's a great one. I know that one. I might not know how to spell it. Am?
S-M.
S-M, just am. Okay, sarcasm. That's a behavior we see. What do we usually do when we see sarcasm? Or we interact with someone who's sarcastic? What?
If
it's directed at you, you get a little angry.
Sarcasm is very painful.
Back off.
Okay, so what we're doing at that point is this is someone we care about now. We love this person. We're invested in them. It's our mother, our daughter, our son. And what we might do is start developing behaviors right away to avoid the sarcasm, which is almost impossible if that's an approach. We've named the behavior. Now this is going to sound a little far out and weird, I know, but actually it does work. You pull together as a family, and it could be two people, three people, whatever, and you name. First of all, you talk about the structure ahead of time. You say, you know, I'd like to try this with our family. So you label it ahead of time, name it. Pull together with the family, and you say, you know, I'm noticing that Mary, you're using a lot of sarcasm. And it's painful, it hurts. So we're going to name it. We're going to talk about how we feel about it. And then we're going to say, we'd like to help change that interaction. And the assumption here is that Mary needs something. If you're responding to the world in a sarcastic way, and it's not funny, it's hurting and biting, what does the person who's using that need and not getting? So the next thing we're going to do as a family is label what Mary needs. Or brainstorm, excuse me. What does Mary need? If someone is sarcastic in your family, let's just brainstorm given these circumstances. What do you think Mary might need? And Mary can contribute to this too. So she can say, this is part of what I need. Attention. Attention.
Affirmation.
Higher self-worth.
Self-esteem,
yeah.
Self-worth. Okay.
Maybe she just needs to be heard and listened to.
Okay, one more.
Love.
Maybe she needs to be touched.
I think she is learning a new way to say what she needs to say.
Great. All Okay, now you as a family have brainstormed. What does Mary need? The next step is, which of these and how can we try and change our behavior to help Mary? Not Mary's behavior, but our behavior. The first thing I would think about would be the words. Mary, when you're feeling angry or sarcastic, we'll help you use words to get what you need instead of the sarcasm. And then people can give examples. My daughter does this for me. I'll say something in a real snappy kind of way, as parents do when they're in a hurry. And she said, Mom, you know, you could try it this way. You could try telling me it this way, and I would like that. So we can give Mary the words to get what she needs. What else are we going to do here? How else are we going to change our behavior? One of the things we can do is when we hear the sarcasm, we can say, can you try and use some different words? Those words hurt me. Or if it's a young child who's approaching us in a negative way, we just give them the words, just like I did up here. I'd like you to try that again, saying, Mom, I need some soap, please. Rather than, there's never any soap in here. How come nobody ever puts any soap in the bathroom? You know? So we're going to give the words at that point. And we can do that. We can use that technique. We can just talk a lot about that technique. So we'll leave that and I'll come back to it. What else can we do here? How can we change our behavior here?
Attend to Mary more in the times when she's not sarcastic.
Great. One of the things we talked about informally in a group the other day is that what happens so frequently is we respond to behavior like we just talked about. I'm not getting what I need, so I develop all these wild behaviors to get what I need, and pretty soon that's all we're responding to. And so what this is doing is saying, what we're doing here is changing that, we're flipping that. So instead of getting sucked into that behavior that comes our way, we are taking the initiative. We are the ones that are coming up and saying, Mary, I'm so glad you made it home for dinner tonight. Would you sit by me at the table? You want to go to the movie with me? That shirt looks great on you. Looks good with your eyes. Just those kinds of things. What I think happens with this one, the positive attention, is that you have to put yourself on a program to do the initiating. So you put a piece of tape on your wrist and you mark off 10 times that you've initiated positively with a person during the day. And it feels so good, and it's not artificial. So we are going to start giving Mary some positive attention that we're initiating. Good. Okay, another one. How can we change our behavior? Because that's what this is about. The reality is, if we're going to heal, if we're going to have relationships where we can say what we feel and think and that kind of thing, can I really make you be different? Can I put you on a behavior modification program that's really effective to change your behavior so you're a nicer person? Can I do that? No. I don't have control over the behavior that comes out of you. But I do have control over my behavior. I can change my behavior. And by changing my behavior, I will get different responses from you. By using different words. By giving you attention that I initiate. Okay, another one. What are some other ideas here? Yeah.
I'm not sure this is an idea. It's just an observation. And that is, when I have a tendency to become sarcastic, it has really nothing to do with what the sarcasm, what comes out of my mouth.
Exactly.
You know, hardly ever. So I guess to figure out what is really wrong, because usually what they say is not what's really wrong.
And hopefully that's what's happening here when we're brainstorming what you need. So when you're sarcastic, tell me what you need.
When I'm sarcastic?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times I don't know. I mean, it would take some time to work through why I'm sarcastic. To name it, because I know, but historically I know that when I become sarcastic, it has nothing to do with what.
Do you feel good about yourself when you're sarcastic?
Oh, there's a certain power to it, I think.
But do you feel good about yourself?
Well, I don't know. It's been a while actually since I've done, but mm-hmm. I used to wish more when I was at home as a child.
So it was a coping mechanism, huh?
Yeah.
Did it push people away? Or did they come in and want to be warm and close?
And maybe that resolves some of it too. Being able to use it to push people away.
Well, something that's not up there is consistency. I mean, I'm just thinking about my own life. When I resort to sarcasm is when I feel like things don't match what people say, where I kind of lost hope. It's like, oh yeah, right. Or that I have a vision of things that should be a certain way and they're not, so I just don't take anything seriously.
So you shut down.
Right.
Your behavior.
But it's what I'm wondering is if there might be situations in which people in the family are not acting on promises made,
honest,
or not acting with sincerity towards somebody.
And so during the brainstorming, you can say that. Mm-hmm. What I need you to do is to be truthful, to follow through with what you say you're going to do. Okay, that's something that come out of the brainstorming piece. So the word here, you know, we start with the behavior in the family, and you can bring your own behavior up, of course, in an adult relationship. Now, I've been feeling this way, and I've been noticing I've been acting this way. Let's talk about what I need. Let's talk about what you need. So you're doing the brainstorming piece here, and then the next step is to put these into action, to change our behavior. What it basically is focusing in and caring enough about that person to invest some energy and time in responding to them, in what they need. And isn't that the root of conflicts? Aren't conflicts a lot of times because we're not heard, we're not listened to, we're not valued? And how do we do that? We always say we value our family. But when it comes to day-to-day interactions, how do we truly do that? Well, sitting down and caring enough to brainstorm how we can help you feel better is a beginning. And then to change your behavior. I mean, what a gift. I'm no longer ignoring you. I'm paying attention to you. That means you don't have to be sarcastic. That means you don't have to whine. That means you don't have to hit. I know it's simplistic, but I've seen it work amazingly. Amazingly. Where we can be working with a child and focusing on that child's behavior and trying desperately to change the child's behavior without looking at what that child needs, and we don't make a lot of progress. In fact, oftentimes then one behavior will simply replace another. But when we brainstorm, what does that child need? What is the behavioral clue that we're getting in terms of what that child needs? And we change our behavior, we see massively different responses. Any questions about this?
Does it work even if real long term? I can see some behavior patterns in my child that seem like bad habits. And I think, and I've been trying, this is really helpful to me. I'm just wondering if it, even with long standing,
Yep. In fact, the neat thing about them is you can involve them in the process. You name the behavior that you're seeing, the long-term behavior. Mm-hmm. You name how you feel about that, or why you're focusing on it. And then you brainstorm from a, what can I do? How can I help you get what you need? And part of that is, again, as much as possible, teaching them words. Oftentimes, what we need to give each other are simply better words to get what we need and want. Now, the changes take time. And one of the things that I notice with this is that, well, oftentimes we give up too quickly, or we don't follow through. And so you really, again, it's a commitment. We're talking about what's important, you know, our meaningful relationship. So it's a commitment to that. And that means that it might be 2 weeks that you're working on something. And then what you do is get together, you sit down again, that's the next step, and you talk about how things are going. How are you feeling since we've been trying these things? And people can say what they've observed. Well, I've noticed you haven't been so sarcastic. I noticed that you've caught yourself and tried using different words. One of the techniques that I use a lot of times with children when I'm trying to change my words is, it becomes a habit. It's like you're saying, behaviors become a habit. And so I give myself permission to say, I might start saying something in a negative way. And I'll stop and say, I'm working on saying that another way. I'd like another chance. And people give us second chances when we name it, when we put it on the table. I'd like to try saying that another way. My mother was a yeller and a screamer. She screamed about everything. We had 7 children. And I remember one night listening to her. On tape, she died. I was staying overnight at a friend's house, and I could hear her screaming through the walls. And I remember looking up at my friend's mother, and their house was so orderly, and the sheets were just crisp. And she brought us chocolate milk and bed, and just this totally opposite experience than what I'd lived with. And I looked up at the mother and I said, and I think I was 10 at the time, "Do you hear that very often?" And she said, "Yeah," not wanting to proceed with this conversation. I said, "Well, like, how often?" And she said, "Well, every day," which I knew. And I said, "Well, like, how many times every day?" "A lot," which I knew. But not only did I hear it at that point, I realized that I had modeled her same way of getting my needs met. If I didn't get them met, I screamed, I yelled. That was the family mode. I also decided that I didn't want to do that. And so I had to retrain myself. And so I had to stop when I started using words that hurt. I had to learn new words. And I had to stop the pattern. And oftentimes it would be midstream. So in the middle of a scream, I'd say, "I don't want to do that." I'd say it out, you have to say it out loud. "I want to try another way." Now, some of us don't scream, we become silent, and you do the same thing. "I don't want to do that. I want to try another way. I want to use words." Now, what I'd like you to do for the last thing is turn to the person that you're with and brainstorm some words that, when you hear them, help you heal. What do you need? Brainstorm what you need when someone has been angry with you or there's a conflict. Because that's the other piece. We all need different things. Think about it for a second and then go ahead. What do you need? You need that you discovered that would help you feel better after you've been hurt.
I'm sorry.
I want to talk about I'm sorry for a second.
Set us up for that.
I'm sorry is really interesting. How many of you that have children forced your children to say, I'm sorry? Yeah. I encourage you not to do that. Usually, again, I'm sorry is a pretty abstract thought. And oftentimes what we're doing is asking children to lie at that point because they're really not sorry. So I suggest, and I'm talking about children 3, 4, and 5, actually till about 7. About 7 is when they really can, that conscience is starting to develop a little more. They're understanding more abstract thinking, and they're really truly beginning to understand what that means. Until that time, we can model. We can say, when I hurt someone, sometimes I tell them I'm sorry, and that helps them feel better. And we also can give them words, other kinds of words to say to each other. We can have them help the child that's wounded or hurt in concrete kinds of ways.
Even as an adult, sometimes that makes me angry, or it makes it worse, and I get mad. And
when somebody says I'm trained, it doesn't become trained. They keep doing the same thing.
Well, that's it. I say.
Yeah. Right. Sorry loses all meaning.
If we don't change our person.
If we don't change our behavior, which is what we've just brainstormed. When we've changed our behavior, then it means something. I'm sorry, next time I will do this, like we talked about.
And I think I still can remember being forced to say I'm sorry, and I was right. I mean, I was fourth grade. I had to go apologize to a teacher because I was wrong. I wasn't wrong, and I walked in. I mean, to this day, I walked into that teacher. Mrs. Lincoln said I had to come in and say I'm sorry. Yeah. So I'm coming in and saying I'm sorry.
Well, and how many of us,
very humiliating,
after we've just had a massive blowout as an adult with someone we care about, are we ready to say I'm sorry that second? Are we? Not me. I don't think so. Maybe in a week, but not right now. And we do that to children all the time. Say, you know, they get into it, and we want that response right now. So think about how you use those words. What are some other ways that you've brainstormed? And I know we have, I'm going to just do one more minute, and then we'll be done.
What words are there that don't become trivial if you don't change the behavior, though?
It's a point.
Well, saying what you're going to do, like you said, I'm sorry. Next time, I'll try not to do that. Or,
and then really commit and change that.
I don't think that would ever be tried.
No,
meant it.
But what you're saying, we can use words. But what I'm thinking about is, when I'm feeling angry, I'd like you to hold me.